You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The American economy has proven itself quite strong and durable over time, but ironically, many of the products that fuel our economy turn out to be short-lived and disposable. In Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, Giles Slade investigates why so many things, from cars to computers, have to be replaced so often. His book is published by Harvard University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Slade to my show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Harley Earl, who was once head of style for General Motors, said, "Our big job is to hasten obsolescence. In 1934, the average car ownership span was 5 years. Now," he was talking in 1955, "it is 2 years. When it is 1 year, we will have a perfect score." So are we now at the point where we've achieved the perfect score?
I don't know what it is with cars, but with cell phones, it's 1 year and possibly less. And with iPods, it's even less than a year, although they're built to last 1 year. New products come out every, 6 months.
Well, there's a big difference between how long they're built to last and whether we feel we have to replace them because something has come along that's faster or better. Yeah. But are they really built to last 1 year? I mean, how do you build something to last, an iPod to last 1 year? Does it, at the end of 12 months, does some wire suddenly come loose?
The lithium batteries are sealed inside the body of the iPod, and after a year, they lose 60 to 70% of their functionality. So it's you can only play your songs for half as long. So a newer model comes out, and you're really encouraged to buy the newer model because it's a lot better than the old one.
Well, this is something that has changed over the years. Didn't Henry Ford try to build things that lasted forever?
Henry built a car that lasted 8 years. And it got him into a lot of trouble because he was competing with General Motors, who put their cars on a 3-year sort of rotational basis and underpriced Henry. And so eventually he had to come to terms with it.
And that was the idea of Alfred Sloan. Who was Alfred Sloan?
Alfred Sloan was a genius. He was the president of, the graduating class of MIT in 1892. And he worked for DuPont. He owned his own company and worked for DuPont for a while. And then he just happened into the job as CEO at GM when DuPont took over General Motors after the buyer's strike of 1920. And he had this old car, the 1923 Chevrolet, that wasn't very good and only had about a 10 or 15% market share compared to the 60 or 70% market share of the Model T. And so he decided to put the Chevy into competition with the Model T. And he tried to do this by creating an air-cooled engine. And that didn't work. And so about 8 weeks before it hit the market, he was confronted with this problem, what to do with a new car. And so he got a bunch of designers in, and they revamped it, styled it up, cured most of the really overt problems with it, but didn't make it into a better car, really. But it looked better. And then he underpriced it in comparison to the Model T, and it did much, much better. And he learned quickly.
And then the next year they had another model, and the next year they had another model, even if it was pretty much the same car.
Exactly. And he found that he couldn't put it on an annual cycle because it cost too much money to make the dies. So they put major model changes onto a 3-year cycle and then made kind of minor cosmetic changes every single year. And they called this the annual model change.
Didn't he come from a very different kind of background than Henry Ford? Did that affect his attitudes about durability?
Yeah, they were complete opposites. He was a child of privilege and patronage, and he was very highly educated. Whereas Henry was a farm boy who worked in Edison's lab, and they had very, very different, they were from different ages. I guess in today's terms, Alfred Sloan would be a child of the digital age, and Henry Ford would be, unfortunately, what's called technological immigrant, someone who had to acquire the technology afterwards.
Or an analog age man.
He was an analog age man. And so his idea of durability was to make things to last, whereas Alfred Sloan knew that technological obsolescence overtook every product.
At a certain point, Henry Ford must have learned his lesson. Is that why the Model A wound up replacing the Model T?
Yeah, it's a he did and he didn't. It's a complete change of consciousness, and so he was forced to get rid of the Model T at great expense. Some people say $200 million. They shut down production for a year. But even afterwards, he said he wanted to make the Model T into a car that that you wouldn't have to buy two of.
But that kind of died, and by the time World War II came around, Ford was doing a different model every year, just like everybody else. And then we got the Volkswagen of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, pretty much the same car. Once in a while, there'd be a change. And it was a giant success. I remember the Volkswagen ad, how to tell the year of a VW, and they add the box for the 1957 photo is blank and contains only the words "no visible change," and that was a selling point. Why did that not last?
It did, in a sense. Volkswagen was playing against the public knowledge of planned obsolescence that took place in the 50s, and people were strongly against it. Fins on Cadillacs became so exaggerated that people saw that they didn't make any sense anymore, and they also knew that their cars broke down a lot. And by 57, Sputnik had happened, and which really shook people's faith in American technology. So people were beginning to question, you know, whether or not making things to break really did keep America on top, and whether we actually needed to do it that way. Volkswagens came along, and they were cheaper, better built, lasted longer, and they had these really brilliant tongue-in-cheek ads that people remembered them better in magazines than the magazine articles in the same magazines.
Think small ads, especially. Yeah. But then came federal regulations on fuel emission standards, and Volkswagen had to adjust. They just became like every other car company. Mm-hmm. My guest is Giles Slade. His book, Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, is published by Harvard University Press. So Volkswagen went along with everybody else, and even now, Japanese cars are more popular because they are perceived to be more durable, but they come up with new models every year as well.
But they're built to last longer. I guess the resale market is longer than those of American cars, and I think that's why there was a crisis in car and truck sales in America last year, because General Motors and Ford trucks are perceived not really to be as tough, not really to be as durable as a robot-made Japanese machine like a Nissan or a Toyota. And I think that's why Japanese manufacturers were able to make so many inroads into the American market.
You talk a lot about disposability in this book. When did Americans start buying so many disposable products? I mean, these are products that we know are disposable, like razor blades or condoms, which weren't always disposable, were they?
No. They used to be, unfortunately, washed and reused. I guess they were made out of pigskin. Or pig intestines, but then there was a revolution in vulcanization of rubber in the 19th century, and they made a vulcanized rubber condom that you could tie on with a ribbon, and that's where the expression "tying one on" comes from.
Still, it obviously there was some kind of a change in the way people thought about products that allowed them to use a product once or twice and then throw it away.
Yeah, the Industrial Revolution brought a revolution in raw materials, and I guess there was paper and steel and tin and all kinds of disposable things, eventually plastics, that made disposability really feasible and cheap.
And women played an important role in the change toward disposability. Nylons, which we know don't have a very long life. What and some other things? You say tampons have been listed among the 50 most revolutionary products of the 20th century by Consumer Magazine. So, and that's understood. That has to be a one-use product.
Yeah. I guess the way that happened, it became a product that was put in competition against the sanitary napkin. The sanitary napkin developed as a way to use up war surplus cellulose cotton that had been stockpiled by, I think, Montgomery Ward, because they thought that they were going to need a lot of bandages for the First World War, and then the First World War lasted a few years shorter than they thought. So they developed these products like disposable sanitary napkins and Kleenex that would appeal to women and would be used and thrown away. Women have been, I guess, the targets of disposability and planned obsolescence since the 1920s when someone, a marketer, discovered that they spend 85% of all consumer dollars.
And that was one of the reasons that some people would point out that a man would buy a suit and wear it for 10, 15 years. A woman would be forced by fashion constraints to change her wardrobe quite regularly.
Sure. And the interesting thing for me is that a lot of the people who came to General Motors from DuPont came as textile and dye-making executives who brought this idea of fashion with them. And that had to go into the mix when Sloan was creating his disposable Chevrolet.
It was also a time when more and more women were going into the workforce. Were
sure.
they playing a role in changing American attitudes?
Yeah, right here in New York at Walter Thompson Agency, there was the very first, female advertising agents and division devoted to selling Mrs. Consumer. I think Frances Maule, who was an early suffragette and feminist, was the head of that division, and their sales were astronomical, advertising sales.
Of course, there were some products that actually built in obsolescence. Isn't it true that General Electric used to deliberately shorten the lifespan of their light bulbs?
That's the first one we know of. That happened in 1932, and that's the first known incidence of obsolescence. There was an antitrust lawsuit, and a memo came up that demonstrated that General Electric had been experimenting with shortening the lifespan of their light bulbs.
Isn't that the sort of thing that actually weakens credibility and reputation in the marketplace? General Electric is still doing okay.
It should do. Usually what happens is there's a trade-off benefit. So these light bulbs that they made were brighter. They cast more electricity, and so they would tell the public, probably in the advertising campaign, that they had to burn out quicker because they burned stronger. My feeling is that it should affect credibility, sure.
There are things that come with lifetime warranties, but they don't last forever. Is the assumption that we're not going to have held on to that lifetime warranty?
Yeah, I think so. I think lifetime warranties should come with lifetime warranties, but I think some of the earliest disposable products were Ingersoll watches. They had a lifetime warranty. You were guaranteed the ability to replace your watch with a perfectly workable watch if you took the old one and mailed it in. Only 3% of the buying public ever did that. And I think manufacturers know that and rely on that today.
My guest is Giles Slade. His book, Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, is published by Harvard University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Giles Slade. His book, Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, is published by Harvard University Press. There's a quote in this book, "If human history reserves a privileged place for the Egyptians because of their rich conception of the afterlife, what place will it reserve for people who, in their seeming worship of convenience and greed, left behind mountains of electronic debris?" And we are. And sometimes we have no choice in the matter. I couldn't find someone to repair a television set a few years ago. I had no choice but to buy a new one. And it was a nice TV. I was very happy with it. I put it down near the trash with a sign that said, "If someone is handy, you can fix me." And it eventually wound up going to the sanitation department.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a television set which could have been repaired. But we also throw out automatic coffee makers when they break, toaster ovens, microwaves, And I wonder how much electronic waste we do throw out every year. Does it all just go into the landfills?
Yeah. We only started counting how much electronic waste there was about 9 years ago, and so nobody really knows. The Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition says that there's 163,000 items of electronic waste, including brown and white waste and IT products, every day. So about 1 million items a week are tossed into the trash. 10% of that is refurbished. 10% of that is maybe torn apart and recycled. 80% of that is stored or shipped to Asia as products to be broken apart for raw materials.
Why not fix them and send them to countries, developing countries, where some of these products would be too expensive for the average person?
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I think most of the value is taken out of them while they're still in this country. So the stuff that's actually shipped abroad to Asia and Africa now is really low value, low grade stuff.
Isn't there a convention that deals with this, the Basel Convention?
Yes, there is the Basel Convention on Transboundary Shipment of Hazardous Wastes. I guess one of the problems is that the title's so long it's difficult to pronounce, but the other thing is that while America signed that agreement, we haven't ratified it, so we don't really honor it in the practice.
Is this one of those things where one administration said okay and another one decided it didn't like it?
I think so. And
what is served politically by not signing it?
Well, e-waste is a tremendous problem. I mean, it's really hard to know what to do with it. And if we stockpile it in America, eventually it will poison us. It can't remain sort of sitting neutrally. You have to do something with it. Otherwise, it'll just leach into the groundwater.
What's going to happen when high-definition television becomes the standard? Isn't there a federal mandate that we wind up with HDTV by 2009? Will all the old analog television sets be rendered useless?
Yeah.
And that means more electronic waste.
There's an interim device that you can buy to, adapt your analog TV to digital format. But that will just create more e-waste. There are, it's hard to know, once again, how many TVs there are in America. I mean, people say that there's 300 million or 250 million, but there's, television has between a 90 and a 95% penetration of the market, and we've been manufacturing them since 1945. So I think, you know, if you say 250, 300 million TVs are going to become junked, these are very conservative things that we can say safely. I think everybody has a TV in their garage. Most people have two or three TVs in the, you know, their kids' room, the living room, their bedroom. I think 300 million TVs with 5 to 10 pounds of lead in each one of them is very, very conservative.
And we have no plan to do anything with this? Is this going to be like the nuclear waste problem?
It's going to be a huge problem.
Is there some cave somewhere in Nevada that we can send all these TVs to?
The problem is that they leach into the groundwater. If the water gets into them, the lead is just one of the poisons in them. They're dangerous just sitting there, no matter where they are. I guess there's two aspects to this. It's going to cost people an enormous amount of money in terms of municipal and state taxes to deal with this waste. Some legislation should be passed very quickly at the federal level to make electronic manufacturers pay for collecting and recycling this waste. And if they do that, then I think the problem will reduce itself for future years.
Now, in this case, many of the television people did not want to sign on to high-definition television. This is something that's forced on them. So they were building a product that, on the whole, did have certain durability, didn't it?
Well, I think analog TVs, you know, you buy one and it seems to last, 5, 7, 10 years. I know I've had my, can I say a brand name, Toshiba, for 5 years now, and it still works serviceably. And I don't intend to change it anytime soon. And I think that's one of the problems, that there's no obsolescence in the market. So the manufacturers want to create a new product that will create obsolescence.
People are afraid to buy new computers because it's likely they'll be replaced by a better model soon. I understand that the speed of a microchip doubles every 2 years.
Yeah.
And if you have an old one, people snicker and say, boy, you have a dinosaur, don't you?
Yeah, there are fashions in these things. And I use a computer and enjoy using it. It's essential to me. But I haven't upgraded it. I think I've got a P4, and I think the last thing I did to it was put in more memory. I keep asking myself now every time I buy a new electronic product, do I really need this thing? I think this is the point. I mean, it's sort of casual consumption of consumer goods and electronics is becoming like casual sex was before the AIDS and HIV crisis. It's casual consumption is no longer an option. There are too many things involved. It's dangerous, and naive consumption is harming us.
But we don't have Jerry Falwell telling us to abstain in this case.
No.
There's also the matter of many of the computers breaking down very quickly. I know somebody who is on his second. The first one, he got the second one from a guarantee, but he's not going to get one from the replacement model. And it did not last a full year. It kind of fried. I gather that from one listener that HP was sued because of an alleged secret code in their cartridges that would allow them to last only 1 year.
Really?
I don't know if that's true or not, but a listener suggests it. If it isn't, I think there's a lot of suspicion out there that this sort of thing is happening.
Manufacturers are aware that the model is going to be replaced within a year or 18 months. I think it's 18 months now for a PC. So why overbuild it? Why spend all that money overbuilding it? Why not save some costs on materials and pump that money into technological research so that they can make the next product?
My guest is Giles Slade, whose book Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America is published by Harvard University Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did you come upon this subject as something you wanted to investigate?
I was teaching American culture in Abu Dhabi when 9/11 happened, and I resigned and came back to Canada. And when I came back, I had a massive culture shock because I was used to taking a lot of – there's a lot of leisure time, I guess, in the Arab states, and I was used to taking a lot of time on social interactions, spending time with people bargaining over a nickel, that kind of thing. And my reintroduction to North American culture was really abrupt, and I started to wonder when we'd lost this the sense of kind of durability and care in our social relationships. And then I started to think, after I did some reading, that maybe it had something to do with the way that we behave towards our material goods.
You write about government-led pro-thrift campaigns during World War I.
Right.
Were they successful?
No.
So this goes back a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this is the, as far as I'm concerned, this is the story of the 20th century.
In fact, you cite Thorsten Veblen's 1899 book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, mm-hmm. as being already seeing some of this.
Yeah, he certainly spotted conspicuous consumption.
That's his phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, that's his phrase. His idea of conspicuous consumption was that a man would earn and conspicuously consume through his wife and family. And of course, that changed. Consumption became much more personalized.
Mm-hmm. Did he have any thoughts about obsolescence, or was that not an issue then?
It was a favorite word of his, he did a lot to popularize the word and to popularize the idea. But it was an age of really rapid technological progress. I guess you'd call it progress. The telephone, the telegraph, the transatlantic cable, electric lights. Things were happening all the time, and things were going out of date all the time. So people needed a word for it, and the word they came up with was obsolescence.
So when the government had these pro-thrift campaigns during World War One and people ignored them, what was the rationale they gave?
Well, the pro-thrift campaigns were really unpopular with the merchants, and so the merchants launched their counteroffensive, particularly, I guess, in the newspapers and magazines of New York, and there was a prosperity campaign, and in New York and in Boston, there was a prosperity campaign, there were banner signs and banner headlines, you know, buy what you need now, pave the way for progress, pave the way for prosperity.
In a way, didn't we see something similar after 9/11? Some people said there should be sacrifice, but we have been consuming more gasoline than ever, and not even recognizing that gas is linked to some degree to the very thing we're fighting against.
Yeah, I think people perceive that gas. People now perceive that gas is linked to global warming. I guess after Hurricane Katrina, it's hard to deny it. But
not to Iraq or Iran, even though we hear it every day.
Yeah, there are limitations in our field of view, you know, and so we can see as far as the horizon, but we can't see beyond it.
What happened during the Great Depression? People must have gotten a bit thriftier. They had no choice in the matter.
Yes, they did. Particularly, I guess by 1932, the fourth year of depression. But while people were getting more desperate, I guess the manufacturers were getting craftier. And 32 is the year when they really started to feel the pinch, and they really began to use planned obsolescence as a tool to encourage people to buy.
In 1932, Archibald MacLeish wrote an essay called Obsolete Man in Fortune magazine. But he wrote it anonymously.
Yeah.
But what did the essay say, and why didn't he want his name on it?
I don't know why he didn't want his name on it. I've entertained several ideas about that, but he was the editor of Fortune, and he wrote a lot of pieces for them, so maybe he didn't want people to think I'm the only guy working for the magazine. The idea was that machines had replaced men as the workers of the 20th century, and this was a new idea peculiar to the Depression. Before that, technological progress was seen as something that would create new industries, and with these new industries would come new jobs, and of course it would create new leisure as well. But what began to be obvious in the Depression, I think, with the introduction of automat machines, was that machines were replacing men, and there was a big scare about this, and that's why MacLeish wrote his essay. This theme of the obsolescence of men, the obsolescence of humanity, keeps coming up again and again.
Although automats now are seen as something charming, something to be nostalgic about, because we realize that there really were a lot of people putting those sandwiches and donuts into the machines.
And making them, yeah.
Today, we have fewer people. We have more efficiency in a lot of those things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where things come already pre-cooked and they just get slapped onto a grill for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some very influential people who have discussed this over the years. John Kenneth Galbraith, who just died last week. Why haven't government policies been instituted to reverse things? Is this really something that is an inevitable aspect of the capitalist system, and therefore something that that people are uncomfortable trying to change?
I think it's an inevitable aspect of the capitalist system that evolved during, I guess, this first phase. But now we're being confronted with the problem of our own waste. So that in a global economy where products are created and marketed globally and then obsoleted globally, you're confronted with what to do with the product once it's disposed of. This has never happened before. And so I guess our challenge in the 21st century will be to develop products that can be broken apart and reused, reduced, recycled, and reused. But reused in intelligent ways, I guess, so that, you know, when you throw out your cell phone, why can't the screen be used again and again, or the button pad, or the antenna? Or, you know, the battery is very short-lived, but perhaps the chip needs to be upgraded.
Some people view the atomic bomb as a sign that humans were becoming obsolete humans.
Yeah.
And Norman Cousins weighed in on that as well. But does that really fit into this? After all, we are the same product that we've been in the past, maybe a little heavier than we were in the past, but still the same product. And more durable. We're lasting longer these days.
I don't know what the question is. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure I know the question either. Just one more thing. Do you think this is a particularly American phenomenon, or is it something that we're now seeing all around the world?
I think it's a global issue now. I think it's an American invention, and that's I guess why I wanted to write the book. It's kind of a history of American technology seen through the prism of obsolescence, really. What I'm trying to do with the book is not so much end e-waste. It's raise people's consciousness and make them examine their own values. I think your earlier question about whether or not it's inherent is a pretty good one, and maybe I didn't answer that question very well.
You mean inherent in capitalism?
Inherent in capitalism.
Because we always want to grow and we always want to improve, and new and improved is a major selling point, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an invention, I guess, of the 20s when this first began to happen. But this is just the way that it evolved. We can do it in a different way. You know, we can have a slightly growth economy where products last longer, and we pay more for them, but they last longer. Rolexes and Mercedes, I think European industrial design has a different aesthetic, and I think America has to adapt.
Do the Europeans do recycling better than we do?
Yeah, they do, and they've got laws on the books that prevent many of the toxins that are in our IT products from being used in their manufacture. And what we have to do is catch up. There's a law on the books there's a law in committee in Congress, actually four of them that are being reviewed. But as yet, the issue isn't as publicized, and the will isn't there to make it a law.
What about Moore's Law?
What about it?
Can you explain it?
Gordon Moore, who was, the co-founder of Intel, noticed that every 18 months, computer chips became more powerful, doubled in power. And what this did was provide an electronic manufacturer with a technological edge to sell new, improved products every 18 months.
And this is something that looks like a good thing, and it is a good thing, and yet it just exacerbates the situation. Thank you so much for being with us. Giles Slade's book, Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, is published by Harvard University Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. What about books like this? Do you think when we see them remaindered, are they also just another example? I don't mean your book. Your book will never be remaindered.
Thank you.
This is a durable masterpiece.
It's made by Harvard University Press to last 50 years. I want to say that.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.